or in the chancel of the church, or maybe even in the shopping center, that the sacred meets us in this way. And if the sacred, on the one hand, breaks the bounds from the beyond with that kind of power that annihilates, from the other side, the sacred comes with a power condescending, being a part of our world, especially when we are most in need, when health is absent, when we are diseased or uneasy or ill. Tonight we want to address that side of the sacred. I'm going to do that by addressing some professions, some of which are represented in the room, all of them in our culture, and easily in our mind's eye. You surgeons have the reputation of being the supreme technologically equipped scientific technocrats of the culture, who are very, very good. But in your reputation, you make the least allowance for the sacred. I think you are God's gift to us. I want you. I want more people to have access to you than those who share my income group or social status. Many of you are believers, you're church members along with all of us, but in the hospital you have the reputation of having to leave everything behind when the surgery room door closes. You're very busy, it depends on your hands, your skills, your knowledge, and in a certain sense you have to arrange things and boss people. You have to dominate and master and control in order to achieve what we want of you. And along the way, you have the reputation of ruling out the sacred, the mysterious. You scientists also wear white coats, a priesthood of our time. You in your laboratories doing your research. You are trying to dominate and master and control mysteries of nature following certain laws. And as you do that, the temptation is to forget the mystery and the sacred. You are God's gift. I, the citizen, I, the person who will die, I, the one who needs your services, I, who would like to live longer and more meaningfully and with more comfort, I want you. I want you sooner, not later, to make gains against cancer and to understand the virus of AIDS and to have breakthroughs in pharmaceuticals that will help heal. No more than I care that the surgeon is a Mormon because there's no Mormon brain surgery, do I care whether, as scientist in the laboratory, you are Baptist using Baptist test tubes. Science may be your sacred cow. We need you. But to the extent that to achieve your profession, you might very well fail to listen to the sacred. You administrators. Max Weber said, to live in the modern world is to live in an iron cage. And anybody who's ever had to fill out the forms to get into or out of a hospital has a little sense of the hold you have in your profession. Something about the complexity of modernity, the many forces needed, the hands needed to heal, has given rise to institutions of government and health and therapy, and between us and them stand you with your computers and your forms. I want you. You may not think I want you, but I want you because I know enough to know what happens when your world breaks down. I've seen the lines. I've seen the anarchy and the chaos in the lands where the Iron Curtain had been. I've seen the absence of meaningful system. But your role as administrator is to dominate and master and control the forms, the systems, the processes. And in the process, you might very well forget your own humanity and your own need to stand in the face of the sacred. You ministers of the gospel, you who have most immediate and consistent access to the signals that the culture at large regards as sacred, you have a terrible temptation through the frequency of your confrontation with terminal illness or any illness or conflict. You have the temptation to dull it, to round it off, to dominate and master and control congregations or denominations or systems. You know you are in a healing profession. The biblical words for saving, as in save souls, and healing, as in heal bodies, or turn the two around, are very similar root words. Not long ago, I interviewed Robert Coles, the Harvard psychiatrist, and he ran through all the professions, and as a thinking Christian, he spent a great deal of time on the frustration he has when the sacred, the gospel, is handled routinely. When the chaplain has made her 24th stop of the day, and it's so easy to rush through it. We know you're busy. Like all the other professions, you've had to learn a language. Wendy Charlton has written a nice book called In Our Professional Opinion, in which she made a study of second year med school and found out how in the second year of med school, in order to be good at clinical language, you have to forget some other languages. And as I read that book, it struck me that's what we do in theological schools too. We teach modes of interpreting Bible, histories of the Christian faith, theology, pastoral care, and in no time at all, we can do it with a distance, losing the poetry of relations and the drama. You therapists, psychiatrists, counselors, you too, we know, are at those quiet junctures of life where the softnesses must occur, where things must remain flexible and open. You're dealing with the mind's mysteries and the complexity of the stories we have. Some of you are at the point of saying we can do best if we just understand what is manifest, namely that a lot of what goes on in the brain and in the stories has to do with neuron firings and chemistry and mechanics. So it's very easy to work out therapies based upon this. I have a friend, John Searle, who is a philosopher at Berkeley, who has made a great deal of study of mind and brain and what it is we work with there. And he points out how in the course of his life, any number of final explanations of what the human is nothing but have already appeared. The technical term is reductionism. We reduce the human to this or that process. Currently in vogue, the last time I saw him at least, it was AI, artificial intelligence. We are nothing but extremely complex high-speed computers that happen to have bodies. A couple of years before, he said we were neo-behaviorists. About 7-8 years ago, it was sociobiology. The human was nothing but the selfish gene making its way. And behind that, behaviorism, and behind that, and behind that, and behind that. And he said, as each comes along, I learn from them, and there is truth in all of them. I just can't buy the nothing but of it. He said, I'm only in my 60s, and I've already outlasted 8 final all-purpose explanations of what humans are nothing but. And we do that in order to understand. I want that. But also to dominate, to master, to control. And to the degree that we do that, we lose the mystery of the human personality, which always eludes the analyst. You nurses, you have the best shot of all. You nurses, I know you. And I know in all conversations on this subject, you're the ones that actually do get to converse through the night, people facing surgery or death. You stand between the system and the surgeon and the order. And when the chaplain goes home, you're there. And there are ever more demands made upon you in the economics of our present system, more expected with less resources. And so the temptation is there too, to, because you must fill out the charts and check the dials, dominate and master and control. If I'd want to start the reversal of the process, I'd start there. I read a great deal on the situation of nursing in our time, much of it written by feminists, because 98% of the nurses in our culture are women, and they have been stepped upon, or by Marxists, a book with a marvelous title, Ordered to Care, and there's a great deal of that. But when I meet with nurses, I always say, let's remember, first of all, that you are a caring profession in which the sacredness of the person you're dealing with has to break through. Well, about the only profession on the front that got by easily in that little run was we academics, historians, theologians, professors who have tenure and thus can criticize all the others and not lose our jobs. We dominate, we master control, we have the power to flunk people and end careers and get rid of deans and other important things in the culture. We serve, we hope, by telling the story, but we're second order in the access. So we need everybody else to help be sure that the sacred breaks through, even in the stories of the sacred. I began with the professions because here is the place where in our world, whatever it was in other worlds, I'm not sure, in our world is the place where the potential of the healing and saving situation most gets lost in our profession. Profession, in most definition, means that we need certain knowledge that others may not have, certain skills, certain ways through the mazes of life, the intention being human service, while we make some sort of living off it. And most students of the history of the professions of the last 120 years or so say that they are very easily corrupted into dominate, master, control. Better to think of our lives as being vocations, callings, than professions or careers, because the call always keeps us closer to the sacred. One of my favorite thinkers of our times, I don't quote him often because his name is so long and we get a 5-minute late start. Anyhow, Eugen Rosenstock Husserl says that our whole life is a response to a call. Who art thou? Before you knew, you were responding to the call of parent. You are named by God and cared for. And that carried through life means vocation and responsibility. And if we are in professions that deal with healing and saving, we do best not to start with the concept of profession, but vocation, call, calling, response to call. And there we're more likely to remain in tonight's term, soft line instead of hard line, for we turn hard line every time we seek to dominate, master, or control. The sacred, I've been arguing now, but it's the third time, comes to us as the other, capital O, tonight as the one who creates the mysterious being called the body, or the social groups like a communion, a nation, a family, who rescues, redeems, and saves when there's plight, be it physical illness or worse kinds, who inspires holiness and reminds us that the body is thus made. And we confront the one. And it is uncanny to watch healing go on, a reconciled person to God, reconciled persons to each other, person coming to terms with body, health returning, and we are told certain, number 3, secrets. We learn a language of it. We learn particular stories The Jacob story speaks to us because we know a larger context for that story. I wouldn't just spring that in Beijing, where I was 2 weeks ago, and tell them that funny story about somebody at a brook struggling with somebody else, and we're not told who. But we get to see it as part of a larger story. And we find that empowers us to face our own struggles, our own diseases, our own struggle with our profession, and we are to be agents, participants. God heals through us. How shall they hear without the preacher? How shall they be healed without the nurse? And I think that in every age, when we try to get at the listening to and the recovery of the sacred, we have to ask, what are some of the particular things that keep those stories and those voices that would call us from reaching us, and what keep us from the full response? On this front, I think many an historian, I among them, have the terrible problem of not being real grumpy. It's much more dramatic to write the decline and the fall of everything than to say some good things go on. And as for the future, I think we can look ahead and see some possibilities. I was on a program once with my own teacher, Daniel Boorstin, who later became Librarian of Congress. We were at a conference paid for by the Annenbergs. I think he's the richest person in America. He just gave the largest gift to universities ever. And he was enamored at the moment of the thought of a man named Jean Gampel, who was reviving the decline and fall of everything theory. And they paid eight of us, probably the highest honorarium in my life, to the best hotels I'd ever been in, to be as gloomy as possible. And Daniel Boorstin turned things around halfway through when he said, "We do not know enough about the future to be absolutely pessimistic." On that note of cheer, I'd like to turn and say, I'd like to say something is happening. I really believe that you can document in many cultures, alas, it tends to be the cultures of at least moderate affluence, in cultures that had overbought the professions and technology, I think you can document a rethinking. In the midst of technology, a German sociologist named Luhmann can write a book called The Age of the Person. The Age of the Person. Somehow, we are finding people who, in the midst of it all, are asking questions about patterns of thought and administration and care that were based around the model of nothing but dominating and mastering and controlling. In fact, some of us would like to think that an epochal shift is going on in many cultures that has a bearing on all the cultures. Not epochal shift the way you have a sea change, you're on a placid sea and suddenly everything is churned or vice versa. But change the way a glacier moves down the mountain. It moves, and up close you see a lot. From a distance, you aren't quite sure. And then you look again, and you find it has moved. It's a glacial change, but I think it's happening. And what I think is happening is we are seeing some measure of breakdown, external breakdown, and critique, internal critique, of those models of thinking that got us to be at some distance from the sacred. The word that many people use these days to describe the world that we inherited in the modern clinic and the modern university and the modern laboratory is a limited word, but we have to name some word. They often speak of the Enlightenment Project. Two and a half centuries ago in France, Germany, England, early America, suddenly people acquired a faith in reason, in science, and in progress that humans evidently had not had before. With it came the belief that they might very well be able to dominate. If only everyone reasons, if only science has mastery, if only progress is given the chance, if we can get over the favorite words of Thomas Jefferson, one of the great ones, if we can just get over superstition and priestcraft, the sacred books, the mumbo-jumbo, the hocus-pocus. You know where that word comes from? Hoc est corpus meus. This is my body. This is my blood. This is my body. And the priest says that, and he has a whammy, and therefore it's hocus pocus. That's what the Enlightenment thought. If we just do enough in these lines, all will be well. I have a colleague, retired now, Langdon Gilkey, who with me often sides enough with the critics of the Enlightenment Project to rejoice in some measure of the recovery of the sacred, and then sometimes we worry about it going too far, because there are things in reason and science and progress which are great boons to the human race. And if we turn our back upon them too much, we will lose a great deal. I have a dentist, for example, who can spot a coward, a lily-livered, chicken-hearted inhabitant of that chair who postpones encounters as often as possible, who awarded me the Chicken of the Year in the Dentist Chair Award, and said, "I will never let you knock technology if by that you romanticize the world before Novocaine and the high-speed drill." And that's to me a little symbol. There are great critiques by the Ivan Ilyiches of the way the attempt to care can produce new disease, as it does in the third world. There are great critiques by great figures like Jacques Ellul of the technological society and how technique can imprison us. I hope I reflected some of that, along with those great gifts. But the Enlightenment had its limits, and we're seeing it breaking down around us. It limited the mysterium tremendum et fascinans. It limited the encounter with the other. It limited the sense that we must live with and struggle with and not always win everything. Eugen Rosenstock Huessy, twice in one evening, who owned 3 European doctorates, German doctorates no less, than which there are no more doctoral doctorates, began to ask the question. He wrote an essay once called Farewell to Descartes, René Descartes. You all know him, Cogito Ergo Sum, I think therefore I am, that the birth of modern science. This having been an utterly grim talk so far, no, I had an optimistic moment. Utterly grim otherwise, let me just remind you, have you ever heard about the time René Descartes was flying from Paris to Chicago, and the flight attendant said, "Would you care for coffee or tea?" And he said, "I think not," and disappeared. Back to the point. Learning had been, Rosenstock Huessy said, based in the West upon the wonderful little motto of Anselm, Credo ut intelligam. I believe, I've seen the mystery, the sacred, I believe, and therefore I believe in order to understand. With Descartes, it came to be, I think, therefore I am. The marvelous introduction of skepticism and criticism without which you couldn't have modern science. A modern constitution. Freedom. Kind of nice things. But Rosenstock Huessy says, in our time, we do need to realize also the truth is not only divinely revealed and skeptically acquired, but socially apprehended. His motto was, Respondio et si mutabor. I respond, although I will be changed. Credo ut intelligam, in order. That's very dominant, strong mastery. Cogito ergo sum. Ergo, boy, you know there's power in any ergo. Therefore. But et si. I respond, although I will be changed. The Enlightenment wasn't ready for that. The internal critique is perhaps more important. Not just that it's falling apart under our eyes from without, but that the people in whose hands it had been are realizing that it has to be complemented by some sort of recovery of the profoundly humanistic or sacred or theological. And many of you read scientists who are among the best humanists today. One of my favorites is Lewis Thomas. You read him? He'd been head of Sloan Memorial Kettering Cancer Research Center, the top cancer place in the country. Theologically informed in his adult life, it's not a vivid kind of thing, but it's always in the shadows. typical one of his many essays. Here's a scientist who writes books with titles like On Late Night Thoughts on Listening to Mahler's Ninth. Yeah. He wrote an essay called To Err is Human, in which he says most learning occurs when something goes wrong. In the laboratory, somebody leaves the specimen on too long, or the temperature 2 degrees too hot, or it's a day late, or something went wrong in the formula. He said, you don't learn from that. You learn when somebody says, but even so, what then? And Lewis Thomas always reminds us of the things the Enlightenment knew it couldn't do, nor can the therapies, and that is overcome death. I once heard him say that we evaded a great deal, but we better come to terms with understanding about death. He said, there's a lot of it going around lately. The Enlightenment Project, I suppose, knew it, but didn't realize it. And it's in the midst of the error, namely, when we confront the person with the new disease, when we confront the things that aren't working in the clinics, when we confront health systems, injustices, casual relations, muffled gospel, we have to say we've been erring, now what? Some sort of shift going on that we must pay attention to. Having learned the gifts of technology, we learn its limits. Now those of you, and I've talked to numbers of you, who have served medically or missiologically or ministerially or businessly in other parts of the world, know that this is a speech very much from the heart of Euro-America, where the Enlightenment Project and technology moved the furthest. And we shouldn't export our cures to people who have a different problem. Some years ago on our campus, we had a marvelous Jesuit from Chile, Father Gaeta. And two of my colleagues started speaking up for his people. How wonderful their world was, these peasants in the Andes, because they didn't have forms to fill out and bureaucracies and professions, and they didn't have all these CAT scans and all these complexities and all that. They went on and on how wonderful it was that they lived just with a medicine man and with nature and all those things, until Father Gaeta finally said, I wish you'd let my people first get your diseases before you try to export the cures you're seeking. I have people who would like to have a little less pain, a little longer life, and they'd like a little access to some of these things. So I think we have to realize that as we learn from that part of the world, there's also some good exporting to go on. But I do believe that something is happening in our time, under our eyes, that we should pay attention to. Jose Ortega y Gasset said, rather provocatively one day, but I really like it, that real history is not made by famine and disaster and war and catastrophe. Real history, he says, is made when the sensitive crown of the human heart tilts ever so slightly, as from optimism to pessimism, from despair to hope, and here I would say from pure Enlightenment technology to a listening again to the sacred to which it had all been directed in the first place. The mind, the brain, all the things that are still to be learned out there. This is a place where the sacred is to be attended to, and often is, through people who are professionally involved with religion. Right after World War II, I read of a U.S. grant of $200 million to the University of Göttingen, and a scientist there was taking around an American party to see how well they were using that $200 million. And one of the people in this group, knowing the history of Göttingen, where so much modern philosophy and theology was born, said, the theology school over there, you know, where the windows need a little bit of putty and paint, and I mean, what are the $200 million going over there? And the man said, oh, theology? They'll never discover anything new over there. Because to him, it was old books that had been studied, and that's it. It's archives, it's museums, it's custodianship. He's speaking just before the modern medical technological revolution. And any of you who are involved in any religiously related therapy or pastoral care know that you've had to do an utterly new run on everything. Same texts applied in a new situation. And in the